There's a good chance that the eye of this hurricane could make landfall right here or just north of here. The storm is slowing down, which means it will sit here and pound the coast. Dangerous winds and several feet of rain.
So will there be another financial crisis? The answer is certainly yes. The greatest risk is forgetting what caused the crisis and forgetting the alertness you have to have.
Apple added an ECG to an electrocardiogram that'll show you the heart rhythm at any time. And it's already approved by the FDA, which is pretty neat.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, three big events this week. Apple announced a slew of new products, including revolutionized the Apple Watch. We also had the anniversary, the 10th anniversary. It's hard to believe 10 years has gone by since the financial crisis and the bankruptcy of Lehman. And of course, we have the big storm hitting the East Coast. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Seems like the only storms this fall are in weather, certainly not in the market, as we had another up market this week. Joining me in the first hour will be Art Hill from Stock Charts. He says this market has a lot of strength behind it, although he says healthcare, which has been on a parabolic rise since summer, is a little bit overextended. He believes commodities are in a long-term downtrend. And he says the gold is directly linked to what is going on in the dollar, as gold has been in the doldrums. But he says, stay the course. He's looking at industrials and aerospace and defense. Ned Schmidt will also be joining me. He said, you want to understand what's going on in agriculture? Just take a look at the tariffs that the Chinese have placed on U.S. agricultural goods. He also said, we've got a problem with the African swine flu. That's going to carry over into prices. But unfortunately for you as a consumer, the lower prices you're seeing in the commodity markets is not going to translate into lower prices at the grocery store as grocers expand their margins. And we'll talk about two agricultural IPO spinoffs that are coming up. The ag sector is also consolidating, becoming more made up of oligopolies. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in hour one.
And coming up in hour two, we take a look at recent comments by Ray Dalio. He's manager of the world's largest hedge fund, and he explains how central bank and fiscal policy typically responds and where that puts us today in light of his macro outlook. Be sure to stay tuned for Big Debt Crises, Past and Future, A Billionaire's Perspective. Well, it's time to turn to the weekly wrap-up report with Ryan Poplava. Ryan, the S&P 500 closed at 2905, up 33 points, up 1.16%. The Dow up 238 points, or 0.92%. And the NASDAQ closed up 107.5 points, up 1.36%. The 10-year Treasury yield is back up to 2.99%, and the CRB Commodity Index is up 0.5%. Ryan, what happened in the financial markets this week?
Chris, there wasn't a whole lot of volatility, but there were some key events this week we can definitely talk about. Namely, the central banks met, the Bank of England, European Central Bank, and the Central Bank of Turkey, which made a lot of news, but didn't really move the markets too much. There was, of course, as always, more trade talk. And then in Latin America, currency issues there still continue. And finally, Turkey lifted rates, as I mentioned, talking about central banks. And this was the big one. They lifted rates more than the forecast had predicted, which really helped the Turkish lira in really just a big way, a big rally in the Turkish lira. I think it was like up 8% intraday. And there were also some economic reports from the U.S. that told really just a Goldilocks story with progress moving forward. Obviously, we know that in earnings, the high consumer sentiment that came out from the Michigan, and then the small business optimism is still very high. And then here we go with low inflation from the CPI print this week for August, though the August retail sales were disappointing. You know, those were some of the main highlights. And of course, there was Apple's product release event midweek that really helped technology stocks, which have been kind of suffering for about a week or more. And that really helped kind of bring things back. Finally, there was Hurricane Florence, was really the talk of the week in commodities because it was causing oil prices to rise in anticipation of some of the oil supply disruptions that we might see. And that caused oil to be up around 4%. But oil was also helped by a very big draw in inventories, much more than expected midweek when we got that report. So that was affecting oil, whereas oil looked like it was almost rolling over for the past month. This makes it appear that we almost tested, I think, 70, or we did at some point. I believe we finished in the high 60s at the week, 68 something and change. Though the storm died down from a Category 4 to a Category 1, this is the biggest storm to hit the Carolinas in decades. And so that is where we were really looking at what could happen to oil. But typically things like this, they're short-term issues. Though all of that has happened this week, really nothing really moved the market all too much, except for a couple of trade talk tweets reports were on trade from the U.S. equity markets, essentially turned around and look just poised to test the August highs this week on some really good news. And then we finished the week on a flat note due to the Trump reiterating again that he wants to raise tariffs on China. So that's pretty much all you had it for the week. Central banks, some economic reports from China that were actually pretty good, and the U.S. were very good, as I said, Goldilocks. And then there we get that really big rally in the Turkish lira.
Now, it seems we continue to see hope and concern when it comes to trade on a weekly and sometimes daily basis. So we go one direction, then the other. Ryan, can you give us any more detail, though, from events this week on trade, since that seems to be the subject that, once again, could cause a huge relief in investor sentiment and cause prices to rise?
Yeah, a settlement could really do that, in my opinion. But yeah, the news continues to be very steady when it comes to trade. That's where all the headlines, probably all the interviewers and reporters and journalists know exactly where the story is. And so, you know, they continue to interview and try to develop that story. But Reuters reported talks between the U.S. and Japan could take place next week as soon as Friday. So we've been hearing some of that. Of course, we had the Mexico and U.S. agreement that really saw the market rally in August. And there was some news that China was planning to ask the World Trade Organization permission to impose about $7 billion a year in sanctions on the U.S. in retaliation for some of the anti-dumping duties. And that's a meeting that's set for next Friday. So that was kind of a negative for the market for U.S. equities. So next Friday, very interestingly, will be a trade-related day, much like Friday was in some of the tweets that went back and forth. But on the flip side, some of the relief came from reports that Treasury Secretary Mnuchin had reached out to the Chinese to renew their trade talks. So economic advisor Larry Kudlow confirmed those reports. So that was a real positive for equities this week. And that led to just an immediate rally in Chinese and other Asian stock indices. But the Shanghai Stock Exchange is still down like 25% from its January highs, right around there. And interestingly, you know, saying equity prices have stabilized, if you look at the chart, because they were not at new lows this week, is I would say probably being a little too overly optimistic. But like I said, it really shows you that what could happen if there is a deal. You know, I personally would be just all over Chinese and EM stocks if there ever is a deal struck between the U.S. and Chinese. I think, you know, the stocks could fly because I think that's largely what's really affected them and has hurt its sentiment. Because in what came out this week was some of the Chinese economic data. And if you look at it, it's not half bad, Chris. Retail sales beat expectations. They were up 9% year over year. I think that was above 8.8% expectations. Those are still pretty high expectations. Industrial production was in line, up 6.1%, and fixed investment was slightly under estimate. Oh, you know, only up 5.3%. So, you know, things are steady there economically. The hard data we're looking at is positive. The soft data, that's the Economic Purchasing Managers Index surveys we get that we talked about it last week, is still not so good. It did rally in August on a lot of good things inside the report, but that was at 51.3. Mind you, 50 is flat. So the soft data that is giving you an idea of surveys, optimism, and that sort of thing has not been very high, mostly due to trade. But like I said, those numbers, the hard numbers, those reports are good.
And Trump announced again that he plans to impose the 25% tariff soon on $200 billion worth of goods from China since it's past the comment period. He said specifically, quote, "We will soon be taking in billions in tariffs," end quote.
You know, when I heard that announcement, Chris, I sort of imagined Dr. Evil dressed up like Trump, raising his pinky to his mouth, saying the word, you know, billions. And of course, staring right at the camera for effect.
Why make trillions when we could make billions?
You know, Ryan, I'd say the second week of September, the Wall Street Journal conducted a survey of business, financial, and academic economists. And these forecasters that were surveyed, according to them, they said that tariffs don't seem to be making much of an impact on the strength of our economy, that the amount hasn't been that significant. But they do acknowledge that it could go up. So right now, tariffs actually imposed are less than 1% of U.S. Gross domestic product. But they said if implemented in full, it could hit about 30% of U.S. imports. And of course, the significance of that is that a lot of folks they recognize that tariffs are the biggest risk to economic growth forecasts going forward. But Ryan, beyond trade, you said there was a lot of central bank news this week. What can you tell us about it?
Well, Chris, it was nothing really revolutionary from the European Central Bank. They confirmed that quantitative easing will be phased out by year end, subject, of course, and as always, to incoming data. And Draghi did mention risks with emerging market equity weakness, so he acknowledged it. That was interesting. You know, we're not doing that over here. And then he also said that financial market volatility, probably stemming from maybe Italy and Turkey, if that's what he was implying, is a concern, as well as ongoing uncertainty related to trade, which as even our central banks are talking about. And then, of course, I already mentioned it, the Central Bank of Turkey surprised really everybody. The expectation was getting more into the detail for the 1 week repo rate to maybe shoot up to around 300 to 400 basis points. But they did well over that, and they shot up 625 basis points, right up to 24% for that rate. And they also announced they're going to start financing banks at the 1 week repo rate rather than the overnight rate, which was higher. And they've, of course, raised that one too. So you can't just raise up the 1 week and not the overnight. The overnight was raised up to 25.5%, which was the same amount, you know, 625 basis points for each. So what was interesting is that there was actually some Turkish lira weakness before this announcement, because Erdogan had made a decree forcing the Turks to stop using foreign currencies and to lend or borrow in just their own. And again, saying high interest rates were the cause of inflation. That's been his remarks all this time. And that's what has caused the currency markets and investors mainly to doubt the central bank would come through, but they did. You know, this is just great short term, but you can imagine what would happen to our economy if interest rates were up at 24% and inflation was at 19%. You know, that doesn't spell great things down the pipe for Turkey. But in the financial markets, this was a big step in the right direction. And this helps investors know, again, the Central Bank of Turkey is finally serious about its policy in dealing with the currency's drop in inflation, which is what investors needed to see.
Now, Ryan, was there anything else you wanted to review? You mentioned Flo, more properly referred to as Hurricane Florence, and a draw on U.S. oil inventories helped to bring West Texas Intermediate crude to go back up this week. But what else is going on?
Yeah, I think the other significant news items this week was the U.S. CPI figure. The core CPI figure was, that's less energy and food, was up about 0.2% in August, bringing the annual rate right around 2 2/10 down 0.2. That's a lot of tenths and twos. Essentially 2.2%. down from 2.4. It was enough to really move the dollar down and cause a lot of those currencies that have been riled by the rising dollar to rally. And again, that helped the Turkish lira, helped some of those South American currencies. But on the chart, and sterling was up as well on it. On the chart, it appears that we have a very confused dollar, whether it wants to head back up towards the highs from last year, or if this recent rally was just a false breakout and bottom. So I'm watching the dollar very closely. It's right, you know, it could go either way. And Chris, I have said it since the beginning of August, the dollar is key on a number of items like commodities and emerging markets and equities. But in the details of the CPI report, apparel inflation and medical service inflation took a very big hit. In fact, one of the worst hits we've seen in many, many decades. So that was hopefully, interestingly, maybe a fluke, but something we'll need to follow. And of course, you know, we need to see the CPI report before the Federal Reserve meets next week. But besides that 2.2%, if you look at the 3-month annualized rate, as things have been coming up, it's underneath the Fed target. It's at 1.96%.
Well, we have a Federal Reserve meeting next week, so the CPI data will likely allow them to continually raise rates at a gradual pace. And I thought it was interesting, speaking of the Federal Reserve, that the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago President Charles Evans said yesterday, he was talking about the recent tax cuts, he said that in his speech that he expects the economy to grow by around 3% this year, but to slow back to around 2% over 2019 and 2020 as the stimulative impact of the recent tax cuts wears off. And he also said that inflation is likely to edge up over the Fed's 2% inflation target.
Yeah, and there were a couple other Fed speakers this week. There was Bullard, specifically St. Louis Fed President Bullard. He reiterated his concerns this week over a flat yield curve, and rates are at a neutral right now. Going any higher would be restrictive, in his opinion. And he's been saying that almost actually since like December. He's very adamant that we don't want to invert the yield curve and having a flat one. And that spread has flattened throughout the summer. And I believe now that long-term interest rates have headed up a little bit, that spread has widened. So definitely the Fed is going to be the big meeting next week. And of course, like I said, trade, I think, will be a big deal on Friday to see what happens with that World Trade Organization with China on Friday. And then also possibly the Japanese and American conversation continues next Friday.
And with that happening next Friday, we'll look forward to hearing your report on that, Ryan. As always, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for stopping by the studio. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
9/11, in one way, it was successful for Al-Qaeda and Islamists, and in another way, it really wasn't. It wanted to draw the United States into a conflict with the Muslim world. Al-Qaeda thought that if it could do that, it might set off a bunch of different revolutions inside the Muslim world against both authoritarian regimes and regimes that appeared religious on the surface but really weren't and had been propped up by the United States in the Cold War. In the one sense, Al-Qaeda has got what it wanted. It got the U.S. to overreact and got the U.S. to come into the region. Al-Qaeda has not seen that type of Muslim-wide revolution that it was going for. And all these various different Al-Qaeda franchises are all trying to figure out what to do. Some of them are still trying to spark that revolution. Some of them are just trying to create little pockets of Sharia or states in the Middle East or elsewhere in the Muslim world. So they were both successful and unsuccessful, depending on how you look at it.
You've just been listening to a free portion of today's FS Insider podcast. To listen to the full interview, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. We cover the economy, geopolitics, global macro, stocks, commodities, bonds, precious metals, technology, and even a little market philosophy. Our guests often provide regular updates and forecasts that are reserved for large institutions, hedge funds, or high net worth investors. FS Insider listeners tell us that we have the best financial podcast on the web. And if you want to check out more, again, go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
Do you know the impact of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to your personal finances? Are you a high-income earner, owner of multiple real estate holdings, or considering divorce? If you are, your taxes may be going up. Come to the Financial Sense Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference by Jim Poplava and his special guest, Chris Hennessy, a tax lawyer and CPA, to explore what the new tax law will do to your finances. The conference will be held at the Hilton San Diego Hotel in Del Mar on October 27th. To learn more, go to www.financialsense.com for information on how you can register. That's www.financialsense.com. Seating is limited and going fast. Don't let filing your 2018 taxes give you a rude awakening. Be prepared now. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market is having a pretty good start to the month. It seems like the typical storms of the fall, the only real storms are actual weather storms heading our way. Joining us on the program from StockCharts.com is Art Hill. Art, I want to talk about something that you published on your site by John Murphy. The number one performing sector this year has been consumer discretionary sector, the ETF. But John took out and made it unweighted, and which really took out the impact of Amazon. Instead of being the number one performing sector at 8%, I think it came in at 7%. I'd like to get your thoughts and comments on that.
Yeah, I remember that article that John did. And if I recall, he was using a ratio chart to compare the performance of XLY, which is, of course, the consumer discretionary SPDR that has a heavy weighting towards Amazon, and RCD, which is the equal weight consumer discretionary ETF. And of course, that one pretty much mutes the weight of Amazon because everything is relatively equal weighted. And that's a really important sector because, of course, it's going to have housing, it's going to have autos, it's going to have a lot of retailers, as well as a lot of ad-dependent things like television stations and stuff, broadcasters. So that's what John was showing, was the fact that, you know, if you took out that Amazon effect, you had RCD actually underperforming XLY by a fairly wide margin. Now, the question is, how bearish is that? I mean, it tells you on the face of it, you want to own XLY over RCD. But when you look at the RCD chart, and as John pointed out in his market message, it was testing its January high when he wrote this at the beginning of September. And I just put out a chart today on Twitter that shows a cup with handle forming. You have a big one that basically goes from like January to June as the cup, and then June to August, or now September is a big handle. And we're on the verge of a breakout to new highs. And I think the trend is up for RCD. So I think it's more bullish than bearish right now. And that's a net positive for the broader market.
Yeah, let's talk about the broader market right now, because it is in an uptrend. And typically around this time of the year, markets have a tough time. It doesn't look that way so far. Many of the indexes have hit recent new highs. So it looks like since May, we've had a breakout in the S&P. It's grinding higher, and you've got a lot of the indexes breaking out. So breadth is still good. So what does that tell you? It seems like we're heading into the fall with a lot of strength.
Yeah, it's like the only argument the bears have is that we're heading into, well, we're already into September, and we're heading into October. And, you know, when I look at the charts, when I look at the breadth indicators, sure, I see pockets of weakness in the market. You look at ITB, the home construction ETF, it's been trending down all year. You look at the broker-dealer iShares, it's been trending down. So there are pockets of weakness that are a concern, but you kind of have to take the weight of the evidence. And I think the pockets of strength are outweighing the pockets of strength still at this stage. So that's kind of what causes that grind, is you, and finance is kind of, you know, dragging on the market because it's not performing that well. And it is the third biggest sector after healthcare and technology, of course. But I think, you know, industrials have started picking up. So I think when you look at the weight of the sectors, you know, still we're on balance. We're still bullish as far as the weight of the sectors and the weight of the markets, because as you said, small caps, mid caps, large caps, and the NASDAQ 100, those indexes all hit new highs in the latter part of August. And that was just less than 3 weeks ago. So we're still in an uptrend.
Well, let's talk about one of the divergences that exist out there. And that, this goes back, Art, to Dow theory. You have the Dow Industrials have not been able to reach their January highs, and yet you have the breakout in transports. Is that something to be taken seriously? I mean, usually when you have the transports taken off, the old Dow theory, that means they're shipping this stuff and goods are going to the market.
That is true. The rails have really been leading the Dow transports higher. Some truckers like J.B. Hunt aren't doing too bad either. And airlines recently took off, pardon the pun there. And FedEx had a move. So it's good to see the move in the transports, but the Dow is still below that January high. It's not too far. So I wouldn't call this, you know, it's about 2% below its January high, so 2% away from, say, a confirmation. I think, you know, if we get a downturn here below that January high, along with this non-confirmation, then we have something to worry about. But at this stage, you know, when I look at all the other indexes that have hit new highs, you know, that tells me that the majority of the market is still okay.
I want to talk about something that may or may not affect the markets, and that is the reconstruction or reconstituting some of these indexes. They're coming up with a new sector for the S&P. It's going to be the communications service. They're going to be moving some of the FANG stocks into it. They're going to be moving some of the media stocks into it. They're going to be reducing technology, which is going to be more like an industrial type sector. Do you think any of this will have an impact on stocks?
No, I mean, it's kind of, I don't want to use the Titanic as my metaphor here, but it's kind of rearranging the chairs, the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, it's still the same stock market. It's still the same stocks. And Google is still a heavyweight, whether it's part of technology or if it's part of XLC, that new communication services sector. Same with Facebook. And that one, you know, really got off to a rough start since it's got some charts going back to the 19th June, and it's down around 3.5% and definitely weighing on the market with the declines that we've seen in Facebook and Twitter. But no, I don't think that, you know, I think it's just because people a different area to concentrate in. And this would be more, say, content oriented because of things like Netflix and Facebook and Google in there and Twitter.
Now, I want to talk about a sector that has not been doing well. We've been seeing bonds gradually rise, although the 10-year seems to be in a narrow range. It's widely anticipated the Fed will raise interest rates this month. Let's talk about TLT, very popular ETF of 20-year Treasury maturities. What is the downturn in TLT? Does this look like a bear market, a correction? What is that saying?
Well, I think TLT is in a bear market. It's in a long-term downtrend because the 50-day is below the 200-day, and it hit a 52-week low in May. And, you know, it has been trading sideways since latter part of February, where it's just moved between, say, 116 and 123, roughly. And it recently backed off resistance in that 122, 123 area for the fourth time, with the decline over the last 3 weeks. So I would expect lower prices out of TLT because if the longer term trend is down, that's where my bias is. And so I think we have failed at resistance and are moving lower. And that would suggest that interest rates are going to move higher.
So let's talk about another sector that is breaking out here and doing very, very well. And that is the healthcare sector, which has broken out from the summer and keeps on climbing.
Yeah, healthcare had an amazing run, and it's at a new 52-week high today. It is one of the leading performers. If you go back to that early May low, it's currently up around 16% from that early May low. And it just had a pretty much moonshot from late July until late August, and then finally rested for a couple of weeks and moved higher again. Now, personally, I think it's a bit overextended. You know, the breakout plays were happening in June and July, you know, when it was coming off of the support levels and breaking out. But now that it's quite extended, I wouldn't force the shot here. I would let the market come to me and let it come back a little bit and pick a place that you might want to enter, like if it comes back to the 50-day EMA. And if you go within the healthcare sector, you know, you're seeing strength in medical devices, IHI, and as well as the healthcare providers, IHF, and even biotechs have gotten into the swing a little bit with a new high in late August, but they fell back here in September. But we got to expect a little volatility out of biotechs.
Art, what does it tell you? You know, you have consumer discretionary doing well. You have pretty much all the sectors doing well. And you've had the breakout, as we said, from summer in healthcare. But you also have some of the defensive sectors of the market that have been doing well since summer. You have utilities. You had the breakout in healthcare. And then you also have consumer staples. A lot of these are going up at the same time that you're still seeing leadership in the top-tiered sector of the market like technology and discretionary.
Yeah, it is an interesting dynamic because what you have here is you have different time frames at work here. You know, if you go on a year-to-date time frame, XLP is still down around 2%. But if you look at XLP, the consumer staples, SBDR, since May, it's had an amazing run. It's up like over 12%. And utilities have also had an amazing run. And I still think, you know, you got to put more weight into the most recent 3 to 4 months than, say, the February, March, April period, because I think I'm impressed with the leadership we're seeing in XLP. And I put out a piece on our website today where I highlighted some of the key stocks in that group, and you can see there, the ones that I highlighted, there were 6 or 7 that are above their 200-day moving averages. So I'm impressed with what I'm seeing in XLP and XLU, the utilities. Now, what does that mean for the broader market? Well, I don't want to extrapolate that just because they're strong as well, that means the market's turning defensive, because we haven't seen these other key groups turn down and break any kind of a support level, like technology or industrials or XLY, the consumer discretionary. So until those big ones start breaking down, I don't think it's a problem for the market.
Let's talk about the FANG stocks, which have been just on fire the last couple of years. We do have the breakdown in Facebook, but everything else is looking pretty good. Apple is a $1 trillion company, and Amazon was there briefly, and the FANG stocks still look like they're holding up.
Yeah, they are for the most part, especially Amazon. It's when you get into these ones that are very heavy into social media. So the FANGs would be obviously Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Well, Google's more heavily into the content side, and so is Facebook. And you can see that those two are acting, you know, maybe it's the election coming up, I don't know. But Twitter's also gotten hammered, and they're heavily into the content side. And if you look at these ones that have a more, say, diversified portfolio of revenue streams or a different kind of revenue stream, like Amazon and like Apple, they're doing much better. And, you know, it's not in the FANGs, but you can't ignore Microsoft. And Microsoft just has one of the steadiest uptrends since that late October gap. It just continues to work its way higher and is one of the most impressive technology stocks out there right now.
You know, who would have thought after going nowhere for 13 years that Microsoft would get close to becoming a $1 trillion company again? You're right. You look at a chart of Microsoft, it looks like an escalator going up at a 45-degree angle, and it's been fairly steady, very few pullbacks.
It's true. That's the perfect angle, isn't it? 45 degrees. It's not too steep and it's not too flat, so it's a really good angle to be. Looks like Sanjay Nadella is doing some good things there at Microsoft.
And you know the amazing thing, and maybe you might want to comment, when we went through the tech bubble, some of these companies, Cisco, Microsoft, you know, they actually had revenues and they actually had profits. But some of these companies, you take a company like Apple, which is now a $1 trillion company. They just announced a redo of their watch and several new phones coming out. They're accelerating their revenues, and it's something that you haven't really seen is these companies that get so huge, but yet they're still growing at double digits. You very seldom see that.
Well, yeah, the law of large numbers is all of a sudden, well, it's not going out the window completely, but you're right. That law of large numbers is being changed with the likes of Amazon and Apple. And I was listening to an interview with Gene Munster, and he was noting that the average selling price has risen for the new group of iPhones. And so that just is more for their revenue growth, because that's what they've managed to do. You know, they've got their average selling price up, and if they do their average number of units, they don't even grow. Well, with that average higher selling price, they're going to have higher revenues. So he was quite bullish on revenues growing even more.
You know, what's amazing about that company, when you think of Apple, you know, I think of Steve Jobs, I think of the Mac computer, you think of it as a computer company, but really what it has done is become a premier consumer products company. You know, whether they're selling you a watch, now granted, a lot of this stuff is technology, but it, in many ways, Art, it's almost like a consumer products company. You don't think of Apple the way you would think of, let's say, Hewlett-Packard, or let's say Microsoft. You think of it differently. You think of it more from the consumer level. It's the only company I know that when they do announce products that go on sale, people will camp out overnight in a mall to buy a product they've never seen at full price. That absolutely amazes me.
Yeah, and it's crazy how much free advertising they get just because of that.
I know.
And these events, you know, that they have are just covered, you know, from the 48 hours before the event to 48 hours after. So, and then I look at my own household. We've got iPads and Macs and iPhones, and we're in the Apple ecosystem because it works, plain and simple.
Yeah, we've got watches. And you know something that I find rather interesting too. You see it with Apple, you see it with Amazon. They're disruptors. I mean, you take a look at what the Apple Watch has done to luxury watches. The Swiss watchmakers have got to be worried. If everybody is going to walk around with a smart watch like we do with our smartphone, what is that telling the luxury watchmakers? It's not as chic as it used to be to have a Rolex. It's probably more chic to have an Apple Watch.
Yeah, I think that trend is moving in that direction, more towards the Apple Watch and the digital. But I don't know if the Apple Watch will, say, last as long as a Philip Patek or a Rolex. Aren't those supposed to be heirlooms that you hand down generation to generation?
Oh, yeah.
I guess you just have to wait until the next wave comes when they come back in fashion.
Well, you just keep them, store them, and pass them on to the next generation. I want to move on to the commodity sector. Outside of oil, commodities have been having a tough time this year. Gold is down in the doldrums. Silver is, well, several of the ag commodities are down there as well. Copper is down. As we close here, your final take on what you see in the commodity sector. Is this just simply a slowdown in China and a dollar story? What are the charts telling you here?
Well, the only positive I can put on gold or silver or copper or some of these charts is that they're really oversold. And you might get an oversold bounce, but the long-term trends have been down. You know, silver, 50-day EMA has been below the 200-day EMA since October, November. So it's been in a downtrend for quite some time. And gold had a crossover a lot later. It wasn't until June, but, you know, it just got hit really hard. And that's a dollar story with gold. All right, gold and the dollar, I totally buy that story. But if you look at oil, well, you know, the dollar went up and so did oil. So the dollar doesn't affect all commodities equally. And copper also. I think it's just a combination of things. It's hard to pinpoint one thing. And I would suggest that China has something to do with it because they're the big heavyweight out there. And I think that what happens in China is going to affect the periphery around China and some of the other countries and economies. So that could be weighing on demand.
So final question, Art, given where we are in the market, it seems to be supported. We have strong trends in place. Many of the indexes, as we talked about earlier, are breaking out to new highs along with sectors. As an investor at this point, what do you do? Just hold, stay the course? Do you add new money? And if you do, where would you put it?
I think you have to stay the course. And one area that I'm looking at is industrials, and in particular, aerospace and defense. The ITA, the Aerospace and Defense iShares, recently had a breakout. And I would look at some of the individual stocks within that group to try and find some potential stocks that may play catch up and move higher as well. Along with that, you got the sector moving higher, industrials, and you got the industry group, aerospace and defense behind you. So I think some other stocks like Harris and Level 3 Communications could play some catch up, as well as Rockwell Collins and perhaps Lockheed Martin.
Art, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your software program, Stock Charts? I use it. It is one of my favorite. In fact, when I start my day, the first place I go to is your market summary page, which pretty much covers all markets, all commodities, all sectors. If you really want to know what's going around the world, you can do it on one page.
Absolutely. You're preaching to the choir, because that's the first page I go to as well. And I go to it throughout the day to see how the markets are progressing. So we do offer a lot of charting tools. We've got the classic, you know, bar and candlestick charts, as well as point and figure charting. And we've got some really good commentary that you can read. There's free commentary, and there is also subscriber-based commentary. John Murphy and myself and Martin Pring are behind the paywall, but you can get other great commentary for free. And other, you can also get a lot of basic charting services for free. And then members, of course, have access to our scan engine, to where they can create their own scans and also technical alerts that can be sent through an email or a text. So a lot to do there. And I recommend you come and take a look. And it's all free, just a not all free, but you can come and look for free.
And that website is StockCharts.com. All one word, stockcharts.com. All right, Art. Well, listen, thanks for coming on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks for thinking of me, and we will talk again soon.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
We went from tools, machines, systems, automation. Now we're seeing autonomy. If you think about all the algorithms, high-frequency trading systems, and software that's able to buy and sell on their own inputs in the financial markets, in stocks, bonds, commodities, you know, futures, you name it, they're doing that not based on programming or a person telling it to buy or sell only this. They're using their own input, they're learning. So once now that we've crossed this threshold of going from just machines or automation that do what we tell it to do to something that is able to learn on its own, that's when we start to see all sorts of new avenues open up. I think Daniel Kahneman, in his System 1 and System 2 way of conceiving of cognitive processing in our own mind, is a good way of thinking of this, because essentially all we're doing is we're now building out that secondary system, which is more of the automated, it's the fast, it operates lightning quick, you know, and it's kind of where we get our intuition. It's the subconscious or unconscious cognitive processing. And that's what high frequency trading is now operating on a global basis. So that's one framework that I like to use, just to understand that high frequency trading is not going away. It's always going to be there. It's just the rate at which information is now priced into the market and traded on is way beyond human level reaction now at this point.
Well, it's been an overall good year for equities. Stock markets, just in about every category, are up, at least if you're in the U.S. Doesn't look as good if you're overseas. But what about commodities? Outside of oil, they've been lagging. Joining us on the program is Ned Schmidt. And Ned, let's begin with a couple sectors, one you cover in particular, which is agriculture. I'm looking at the ETF DBA. It's down. I'm looking at deer. It's struggling. So let's begin. What's going on with the ag sector?
Well, we've got three things that are going on. And the big one is the big negative, which is the tariffs that were put on U.S. agriculture products by the Chinese government. In essence, there's at least a 25% tariff on anything going to China from the United States, which means what Chinese importers are doing is not buying any U.S. grain. But complicating the matter is some other things going on, which is African swine flu and the Roundup debate, or whatever you want to call it. But the big thing is been the Chinese tariffs. Now, there is some good news because the market overdid it. And it, with the exception of U.S. soybeans, the rest of the grains seem to have put in bottom. And so we may have been somewhat past the worst of the impact of the tariffs. Now, what's going on is China didn't run the numbers before they made this decision. China just said, well, we'll just go buy Brazilian soybeans. The other thing that happened today was the announcement of the WASDE came out, which is the World Agricultural Supply Demand Estimates. And they've raised the U.S. harvest to a near record size. That expectation has been depressing those grain prices. But we've got a couple of things going. Like I said, the African swine flu problem in China. African swine flu is deadly to pigs. They die in about a week, and there's no known vaccine or cure or anything. And this swine flu started in Africa, hence the name African swine flu. It traveled up into Europe, primarily Eastern Europe, where it's wreaking havoc right now. Traveled all the way across the Soviet Union into China. And the last report we had was that there were 18 infected sites in China. That's known sites. What that means is in China, in any province where swine flu is discovered, no hogs can move. You can't take a hog to the slaughterhouse. So we're going to see a shortage, the likelihood of a shortage in Africa for pork. Well, that leaves only one place for them to come and get pork, and that is the United States, because we actually, again, our two oceans keep us from having contact with wild animals that are infected. The other thing is pork ships from the United States out. We don't import pork, much of it, from anybody. So that could be one of the things that turns around.
Let me put this in perspective. With the decline in ag commodities, will this translate into lower prices at the supermarket for consumers?
No, not meaningful anyhow. Well, it's a hard question to answer because you don't buy corn at the grocery store. You buy a steak that has been raised on corn. So that cost of corn is very small in that steak you buy. The other thing that's happened is the retailers are expanding their margins. The first thing they do is expand their margins, and that's what they're doing now. I mean, given where the price of pork was in the United States a month ago, pork prices should have been significantly lower in the United States. Bacon should have been a lot cheaper than it is. Retailers have expanded their margin.
You know, one thing that strikes me about the ag sector is the consolidation. Because if you look at grain distributors, Ned, we're down to three. Bunge, Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill. If you're talking about tractor companies, you're talking about one or two companies. If you're talking about chicken producers, you're only talking about two or three companies. If you're talking about seed companies, you're only talking about one or two. So the whole sector, surprisingly, is in the hands of few players. And what that does is it creates an oligopoly. And when you have an oligopoly, you have, and you're seeing this even in the grocery store chains where it's consolidating. One grocery chain is buying up the other. So even though the prices have fallen, as you just mentioned, what the retailers are doing are expanding their margins. So consumers end up paying higher prices.
Right. And you add to that the fussy nature of U.S. consumers. While the Chinese are fussy consumers, I mean, there's a lot of waste in the way we produce food at the grocery store. I mean, the trash, the garbage that's made in the produce department, it's just amazing. And people want things to look nice and pretty. They want their bacon to be cut a certain way so it looks nice. And that adds to it. Now, the one thing that I don't know how it's going to unfold is Roundup. Monsanto lost a massive lawsuit a couple of weeks ago, which was a dubious, no, it was a dumb jury verdict. I mean, totally dumb. Then, about a week after that, we had a court in Brazil ban Roundup, which would have caused serious problems in Brazil because they don't have an alternative. Well, the judge down there reversed it, at least temporarily. The problem we got is as weak as Roundup has become, we don't have viable alternatives yet. Or some of the alternatives we have include Roundup as part of their mix. And so we could see a reduction in herbicides, especially if this sue the manufacturer mentality expands. And I think it will. So that could hurt yields in both the United States and Brazil if people start being reluctant to use herbicides because they're afraid they'll get sued.
I want to move on to two of the biggest distributors of grain, Bunge and Archer Daniels Midland. If you look at the charts of both, Ned, they look like the opposite side of escalators in a department store. I mean, seriously.
Yeah,
you look at it. Yeah, you look at a chart of Archer Daniels Midland, and it looks like an escalator up at a 45-degree angle. You look at a chart of Bunge, it's an escalator down at a 45-degree angle. What's going on between these two companies? I mean, they're the two biggest.
ADM has done a better job of managing the company, and it has been repositioning itself to exploit the Asian market. Bunge is still largely fixated on Brazil, which is an ideal place to grow grains, but it's not an ideal place to try and ship them out of. And so BG is the symbol for Bunge. Is their management just doesn't seem to have been caught on to what needs to be done. And ADM seems to be one of those stocks that's been chosen to represent the ag sector. In other words, ADM is the first choice right now. And so that's the difference. BG is a distant third. Also, there were two opportunities to sell the company, and BG muffed them both. And so investors have gone somewhere else. Now, we've got some two companies coming, which will be split out of another company. DowDuPont is still on a path to spinning off its agricultural subsidiary, which is seeds and crop protection, largely out of the old DuPont. That stock is likely to have a lot of interest. The other one is coming out of Eli Lilly, which is Elanco, and they're going to do an IPO. Well, what they're going to do first is spin off some of that stock to the shareholders and then do an IPO. And there's likely to be lots of interest in that stock because Zoetis and TAHC, those two stocks have done phenomenally well. I mean, they're treated almost as gods the way the stocks are done.
Well, this will be good for the ag sector, Ned, because like I said, it has really become a series of oligopolies. I mean, whether it's a couple tractor companies, a couple grain distributors, a couple seed companies, a couple fertilizer companies, the whole sector as a whole has consolidated into the hands of a few companies. I want to move on to another area that you cover, and that is gold. We've had a strong dollar. We have the U.S. in the best shape of any economy around the globe. You have interest rates here that are rising. I mean, you know, who would have thought the U.S. treasuries almost look like junk bond yields when you compare them to yields in, let's say, Japan or Europe. What is it going to take to get a catalyst for the gold market? Because there's absolutely no fear in the market. The dollar is strong. So to me, I look at a chart of gold, it's in the doldrums, whether you look at the stocks themselves or you look at the metal itself. And silver is down in the dumps. So what's your take here on metals? Are we just in a no man's zone here for a while until we get a catalyst?
If you're waiting for the catalyst, you may miss it. I mean, it looks like now that the August low in gold was the low for gold, because what had been driving the dollar is Trump's tariffs on the Chinese. The people were saying, well, if Trump is going to eliminate our $500 billion deficit with China, the dollar is going to scream. And like today, when there was a rumor that trade talks between the U.S. and China were going to happen again, the dollar fell dramatically and gold rallied. But what we don't want to do is what is very common, is people are comparing trough gold to peak stock. Okay, you got to compare them at like points in the market. And so if we compare gold to, say, the NASDAQ, which is the epitome of speculation. I mean, the NASDAQ Composite Index is a measure of speculation. And if you look at that, the ratio of gold to the NASDAQ, you got to go back to the end of 2001, beginning of 2002, when gold was under $300. So gold is horribly mispriced relative to speculative stocks in the U.S. Now, the thing that's going to help us, Jim, is we need to remember that nobody's making any money in the U.S. stock market. I mean, the S&P 500 since January 26th is up 0.4%. People are confusing new highs with return. My money market fund makes a new high every month, but it's got a miserable return. So I think you're looking at gold at a trough and the NASDAQ Composite or NASDAQ 100 at peaks. And so gold is the one that people should be looking for. The stocks fell dramatically recently in an inverted parabolic formation, which is one of the formations we know what does. And it's moved out of that in a lateral pattern, which is the natural move. So I think at this point today, you have to say the low in dollar gold was last month. And add to that, Jim, the only people that are bearish on gold are in the United States and perhaps Canada. Recently, the World Gold, what is it called, the Gold Council or whatever it is, World Gold Council, put out their measures of what's been happening to ETFs. And in August, U.S. investors sold 44 tons of gold, where in Europe and Asia have been buying gold. We're the only one that's our net sellers. So are we right and the rest of the world wrong? That might be a cavalier attitude, Jim.
Well, as we close here, Ned, given where the markets are right now, given what we've seen, there's almost divergences everywhere. As we just mentioned, we talked about two stocks, Bunge and Archer Daniels Midland. One is going up, the other one is going down, almost in equal proportion. And there's very few companies to invest in. What would you be doing right here, given where ag prices are right now, and we're still involved in this tariff fight with China that hasn't cleared up? Would you sit on the sidelines? Would you put some money to work? What would you be doing?
There's always going to be some stocks in the group that go up. Archer Daniel Midland is probably one of those. The two I mentioned that are coming, Elanco and the ag subsidiary out of Dow DuPont, those are going to be under-owned shares. But the others, until we resolve the tariff, I don't see money of size going into those stocks, Jim, regretfully. But it'd probably be the time, sometime toward year-end, like late November, when looking at the ag stocks would be very timely.
Ned, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you have two newsletters, one that covers the agricultural sector and also the gold market. Why don't you tell them how they can find you?
I have two websites where you can go and read samples. One is the AgriFood Value View. The other is the Value View Gold Report. You can go there and read samples of my work.
All right, and you're one of the few analysts I know that cover the ag sector. Ned, I want to thank you for joining us. Hopefully, you will be out of the way of this storm that's about to hit the East Coast. Stay dry and come back and talk to us again, all right?
All right, Jim. Take care.
thank you for joining us for the first part of the Financial Sense News Hour. Do stay tuned, where we discuss in depth comments made by Ray Dalio. Again, he's the manager of the world's largest hedge fund, and he recently published a 500-page book. We have a link where you can download that book for free on our website at financialsense.com. Stay tuned for Big Debt Crises, Past and Future, A Billionaire's Perspective. Coming up next on The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.